Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Shepard, the Sincere Convert. Last time we did chapter 2, which was that this God made all mankind at first in a most glorious and happy estate like unto himself. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on with chapter 3 for this reading. And I'll go ahead and start that now. It's titled, That all mankind is fallen by sin from that glorious estate he was made in into a most woeful and miserable condition. Now he begins, the devil abusing the serpent and man abusing his own free will overthrew Adam and in him all his posterity by sin, Genesis 3 verses 1 to 3, etc. Now man's misery appears in these two things. Number one, his misery in regard of sin, and number two, his misery in regard of the consequences of sin. Number one, his misery in regard of sin appears in these particulars. Number one, every man living is born guilty of Adam's sin. Now the justice and equity of God in laying this sin to every man's charge, though none of Adam's posterity personally committed it, appears thus. First, if Adam standing, all mankind had stood. So if he had stood, all mankind would have stood. Then it is equal that he, falling, all his posterity should fall. All our estates were ventured in this ship. Therefore, if we should have been partakers of his gains, if he had continued safe, it is fit we should be partakers of his loss too. But secondly, we are all in Adam as a whole country in a parliament man. The whole country does what he does. And although we made no particular choice of Adam to stand for us, yet the Lord made it for us, who, being goodness itself, bears more goodwill to man than he can or could bear to himself, that man could bear to himself, and being wisdom itself, made the wisest choice and took the wisest course for the good of man. For this made most of men's safety and quiet, for if he had stood, all fear of losing our happy estate had vanished, whereas if every man had been left to stand or fall for himself, a man would ever have been in fear of falling. And again, this was the sure way to have all men's estates preserved, for having the charge of the estates of all men that ever should be in the world, he was the more pressed to look the more about him, and so to be more watchful, that he be not robbed, and so undo and procure the curses of so many thousands against him. Adam was the head of mankind, and all mankind naturally are members of that head. And if the head invent and plot treason, and the head practice treason against the king or state, the whole body is found guilty, and the whole body must needs suffer. Adam was the poisoned root and cistern of all mankind. Now the branches and streams being in the root and spring originally, they therefore are tainted with the same poisoned principles. If these things satisfy not, God has a day coming wherein he will reveal his own righteous proceedings before men and angels, Romans 2, verse 4. Oh, that men would consider this sin, and that the consideration of it could humble people's hearts. If any mourn for sin, it is for the most part for other foul actual sins. Few for this sin that first made the breach and began the controversy between God and man. Next unto the sin against the Holy Ghost and contempt of the gospel, this is the greatest sin that cries loudest in God's ears for vengeance day and night against the world of men. For now men's sins are against God in their base and low estates. But this sin back then was committed against Jehovah when man was at the top of his preferment. Rebellion of a traitor on a dunghill is not so great as a favorite in court. Little sins against light are made horrible. No sin by any man committed was ever against so much light as Adam had. This sin was the first that ever displeased God. Drunkenness deprives God of the glory of sobriety, whoring of chastity. But this sin darkens the very sun, S-U-N, defaces all the image of God, the glory of man, and the glory of God in man. This is the first sin ever did you mischief. This sin, like a captain, has gathered together all those troops and swarms of sins that now take hold upon you. Thank this sin for a hard heart you so much complain of. Thank this sin for that hellish darkness that overspreads you. This has raised Satan, death, judgment, hell, and heaven against you. Oh, consider these sins that are packed up in this evil. Number one, fearful apostasy from God like a devil. Number two, horrible rebellion against God in joining sides with the devil and taking God's greatest enemy's part against God. Number three, woeful unbelief in suspecting God's threat to be true or not. Number four, fearful blasphemy in conceiving the devil, God's enemy and man's murderer, to be more true in his temptations than God in his threatening. Number five, horrible pride in thinking to make this sin of eating the forbidden fruit to be a step and a stair to rise higher and to be like God himself. Number six, fearful contempt of God, making bold to rush upon the sword of the threatening secretly, not fearing the plague denounced. Number seven, horrible unthankfulness when God had given him all but one tree, and yet he must be fingering after that too. Number eight, horrible theft in taking that which was none of his own. Number nine, horrible idolatry in doting upon and loving the creature more than God, the Creator, who is blessed forever. You, therefore, that now say, no man can say, black is your eye, you have lived civilly all your days, look upon this one grievous sin, take a full view of it, which you have never shed one tear for as yet, and see your misery by it, and wonder at God's patience. He has spared you, who was born branded with it, and has lived guilty of it, and must perish forever for it, if the Lord from heaven pity you not. But here is not all. Consider, secondly, every man is born stark dead in sin, Ephesians 2, verse 1. He is born empty of every inward principle of life, void of all grace, and has no more good in him, whatsoever he thinks, than a dead carrion has. And he is under the power of sin, as a dead man is under the power of death, and cannot perform any act of life. Their bodies are living coffins to carry a dead soul up and down in. It is true, I confess, many wicked men do many good actions, as praying, hearing, and alms deeds, but it is not from any inward principle of life. External motives, like plummets on a dead yet artificial clock, set them a-running. Jehu was zealous, but it was only for a kingdom. The Pharisees gave alms, but only to be seen of men. If one write a will with a dead man's hand deceased, that will cannot stand in any law. It was not his will, but it was not writ by him by any inward principle of life of his own. Pride makes a man preach, pride makes a man hear and pray sometimes. Self-love stirs up strange desires in men, so that we may say, this is none of God's act by his grace in the soul, but pride and self-love. Bring a dead man to the fire, and chafe him, and rub him, and you may produce some heat by this external working upon him. But take him from the fire again, and he is soon cold. So many a man that lives under a sound minister, under the lashes and knock of a chiding, striving conscience. He has some heat in him, some affections, some fears, some desires, some sorrows stirred. Yet take him from the minister and his chafing conscience, and he grows cold again presently because he wants or lacks an inward principle of life. Which point might make us to take up a bitter lamentation for every natural man? It is said, Exodus 12:30, that there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house wherein there was not one found dead. O Lord, in some towns and families, what a world of these are there! Dead husband, dead wife, dead servants, dead children, walking up and down with their sins, as fame says some men do after death, with grave clothes about them, and God only knows whether ever they shall live again or not. How do men lament the loss of their dead friends? Oh, thou hast a precious soul in your bosom stark dead. Therefore, lament your estate and consider it seriously. First, a dead man cannot stir nor offer to stir. A wicked man cannot speak one good word or do any good action if heaven itself did lie at the stake for doing it, nor offer to shake off his sins, nor think one good thought. Indeed, he may speak and think of good things, but he cannot have good speeches nor good thoughts, the thoughts themselves, as a holy man may think of evil things, as of the sins of the times. The thought of those evil things is good, not evil. Secondly, a dead man fears no dangers, though never so great, though never so near. Let ministers bring a natural man tidings of the approach of the devouring plagues of God denounced, he fears them not. Thirdly, a dead man cannot be drawn to accept of the best offers. Let Christ come out of heaven and fall about the neck of a natural man, and with tears in his eyes beseech him to take his blood, himself, his kingdom, and leave his sins. He cannot receive this offer. Fourthly, a dead man is stark blind and can see nothing, and stark deaf and hears nothing. He cannot taste anything. So a natural man is stark blind. He sees no God, no Christ, no wrath of the Almighty, no glory of heaven. He hears the voice of a man, but he hears not the voice of God in a sermon. He savoreth not the things of God's Spirit. Fifthly, a dead man is senseless and feels nothing. So cast mountains of sin upon a wicked man, he feels no hurt until the flames of hell break out upon him. Sixthly, a dead man is a speechless man. He cannot speak unless it be like a parrot, the animal, a parrot, that parrots things. Seventhly, he is a breathless man. A natural man may say a prayer or devise a prayer out of his memory and wit, or he may have a few short-winded wishes, but to pour out his soul in prayer, in the bosom of God, with groans unutterable, he cannot. I wonder not to see so many families without family prayer. Why? They are dead men and lie rotting in their sins. Eighthly, a dead man has lost all beauty. So a mere natural man has lost all glory. He is an ugly creature in the sight of God, good men, and angels, and shall one day be an abhorring to all flesh. Ninthly, a dead man has his worms gnawing him. So natural men have the worm of conscience breeding now, which will be gnawing them shortly. And lastly, dead men want nothing or lack nothing but casting into the grave. So there wants nothing but casting into hell for a natural man. So that as Abraham loved Sarah well while living, yet when she was dead, he seeks for a burying place for her to carry her out of his sight. So God may let some fearful judgment loose and say to it, take this dead soul out of my sight, etc. It was a wonder that Lazarus, though lying but 4 days in the grave, should live again. Oh, wonder you that ever God should let you live that has been rotting in your sin 20, 30, perhaps 60 years altogether. Overall point number three, every natural man and woman is born full of all sin, Romans 1:29, as full as a toad is of poison, as full as ever his skin can hold, mind, will, eyes, mouth, every limb of his body, and every piece of his soul is full of sin. Their hearts are bundles of sin. Hence Solomon said, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, whole treasures of sin. An evil man, said Christ, out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth evil things, nay, raging seas or oceans of sin. The tongue is a world of mischief. What is in the heart then? For out of the abundance of the heart the tongue speaketh. So that, look about you and see, whatever sin is broached and runs out of any man's heart into his life through the whole world, all those sins are in your heart. Your mind is a nest of all the foul opinions, heresies that ever were vented by any man. Your heart is a foul sink of all atheism, sodomy, blasphemy, murder, whoredom, adultery, witchcraft, buggery, so that if you have any good thing in you, it is but as a drop of rose water in a bowl of poison, where fallen it is all corrupted. It is true you feel not all these things stirring in you at one time, no more than Hazael thought he was or should be such a bloodsucker when he asked the prophet Elisha if he were a dog, but they are in you like a nest of snakes in an old hedge. Although they break not out into your life, they lie lurking in your heart. They are there as a filthy puddle in a barrel, which runs not out because you happily want or lack the temptation or occasion to broach and tap your heart, or because of God's restraining grace by fear, shame, education, and good company, you are restrained and bridled up, and therefore, when one came to comfort that famous picture, pattern, and monument of God's justice by 7 years' horror and grievous distress of conscience, when one told him he never had committed such sins as Manasseh, and therefore he was not the greatest sinner since the creation, as he conceived, he replied that he should have been worse than ever Manasseh was if he had lived in his time and been on his throne. Mr. Bradford would never have looked upon anyone's lewd life with one eye, but he would presently return with his own breast with the other eye and say, in this my vile breast remains that sin, which, without God's special grace, I should have committed as well as he, as this other person. Oh, methinks this might pull down men's proud conceits of themselves, especially such as bear up and comfort themselves in their smooth, honest, civil life, such as through education have been washed from all foul sins. They were never tainted with whoredom, swearing, drunkenness, or profaneness, and here they think themselves so safe that God cannot find in his heart to have a thought of damning them. Oh, consider of this point, which may make you pull your hair from your head and turn your clothes to sackcloth and run up and down with amazement and paleness in your face and horror in your conscience and tears in your eyes. What though your life be smooth? What though your outside, your sepulcher be painted? Oh, you are full of rottenness, of sin within. Guilty, not before men, as the sins of your life make you, but before God, of all the sins that swarm and roar in the whole world at this day, for God looks to the heart. Guilty you are, therefore, of heart whoredom, heart sodomy, heart blasphemy, heart drunkenness, heart buggery, heart oppression, heart idolatry. And these are the sins that terribly provoke the wrath of Almighty God against you. Isaiah 57:17, "For the iniquity of his covetousness," says our translation, "I smote him." But the Hebrew renders it better, "For the iniquity of his concupiscence, which is the sin of his heart and nature, I smote him." As a king is angry and musters up his army against rebels, not only which brings his soldiers out to fight, but who keeps soldiers in their trenches ready for to fight. These sins of your heart are all ready armed to fight against God at the watchword or alarm of any temptation. Nay, I dare affirm and will prove it, that these sins provoke God to anger and are as bad, if not worse, than the sins of your life. For, number one, the sin of your heart or nature is the cause, the womb, that contains, breeds, brings forth, suckles all the litter, all the troop of the sins that are in your life, and therefore giving life and being to all other, it is the greatest sin. Number two, sin is more abundantly in the heart than in the life. An actual sin is but a little breach made by the sea or oceans of sin in your heart, where all sin, all poison, is met and mingled together. Every actual sin is but a shred broken off from the great bottom of sin in the heart. And hence Christ said, "Out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh, and out of the evil treasure of the heart we bring forth evil things." A man spending money, I mean sin in the life, is nothing to his treasure of sin in the heart. Number three, sin is continually in the heart. Actual sins of the life fly out like sparks and vanish, but this brand is always glowing within. The toad spits poison sometimes, but it retains and keeps a poison-full nature always. Hence the apostle calls it sin that dwells in me, that is, which always lies and remains in me. So that in regard of the sins of your heart, you do rend in pieces and break, number one, all the laws of God, number two, at one clap, number three, every moment of your life. Oh, methinks the thought of this might rend a heart of rock in pieces, to think I am always grieving God at all times, whatsoever I do. Number four, actual sins are only in the life and outward porch. Sins of the heart are within the inward house. One enemy within the city is worse than many without or outside. A traitor on the throne is worse than a traitor in the open field. The heart is Christ's throne. A swine in the best room is worse than in the outward house. More I might say, but thus you see, sins of the life are not so bad or as bad, nor provoke God's wrath so fiercely against you as the sins of your heart. Mourn, therefore, not so much that you have not been so bad as others are, but look upon your black feet, look within your own heart, and lament that, in regard of your sins there, that you are as bad as any. Mourn not so much merely that you have sinned, as you have a nature so sinful, that it is your nature to be proud, and your nature to be vain and deceitful, and loathe not only your sins, but yourself for your sin, being brimful of unrighteousness. But here is not all. So consider fourthly, overall point four, that whatever a natural man does is sin. As the inside is full, so the outside is nothing else but sin, at least in the sight of a holy God, though not in the sight of blind, sinful men. Indeed, he may do many things which, for the matter of them, are good, as he may give alms, pray, fast, come to church, but as they come from him, as the natural man, they are sin, As a man may speak good words, but we cannot endure to hear him speak because of his stinking breath, which defiles them. Some actions, indeed, from their general nature, are indifferent, for all indifferences lie in generals. But every deliberate action, considered with all its circumstances, or in individuo with all its circumstances, as time, place, motive, and end or purpose, is either morally good or morally evil, as may be proved easily. Morally good in good men, and morally evil in unregenerate and bad men. For let us see particular actions of wicked men. Number one, all their thoughts are only evil, and that continually. Genesis 6, verse 5. Number two, all their words are sins. Psalm 50, verse 16. Their mouths are open sepulchres, which smell filthy when they are opened. Number three, all their civil actions are sins, as their eating, drinking, buying, selling, sleeping, and plowing. Proverbs 21, verse 4. Number four, all their religious actions are sins, as coming to church and praying, Proverbs 15, verses 8 and 9, and Proverbs 28, verse 9, fasting and mourning, roar and cry out of yourself till doomsday, they are sins, Isaiah chapter 58. Number five, all their most zealous actions are sins, as Jehu, who killed all Baal's priests, because his action was outwardly and materially good, therefore God rewarded him with temporal favors, but because he had a hawk's eye to get and settle a kingdom to himself by this means, and so was theologically evil, therefore God threatens to be revenged upon him. Hosea 1 verse 4. Number 6, their wisdom is sin. Oh, men are often commended for their wisdom, wit, and parts. Parts, I believe, are abilities. Yet those wits and that wisdom of theirs are sin. Romans chapter 8. The wisdom of the flesh is enmity against God. Now, thus, all they have or do are sins. For how can he do any good action whose person is filthy? A corrupt tree cannot bring forth good fruit. You are out of Christ. Therefore, all your good things, all your kindness done unto the Lord, and for the Lord, as you think, are most odious to him. Let a woman seek to give all the content of her husband that may be, not out of any love to him, but only out of love to another man. He abhors all that she does. Every wicked man wants or lacks an inward principle of love to God and Christ, and therefore, though he seeks to honor God, never so much, all that he does being done out of love to himself, God abhors all that he performs. All the good things a wicked man does are for himself, either for self-credit or self-ease or self-content or self-safety. He sleeps, prays, hears, speaks, professes for himself alone. Hence, acting always for himself, he commits the highest degree of idolatry. He plucks God out of his throne and makes himself a god, because he makes himself his last end or purpose in every action. For a man puts himself in the room of God as well by making himself his finis ultimus, as if he should make himself primus principium, or the first principle, I guess. Sin is a forsaking or departing from God. Now, every natural man remaining always in a state of separation from God, because he always wants or lacks the bond of union, which is faith, is always sinning. God's curse lies upon him. Therefore, he brings out nothing but briars and thorns. He has an objection, but you will say, if our praying and hearing be sin, why should we do these duties? We must not sin. Answer number one, Good duties are good in themselves, although coming from your vile heart, they are sins. Number two, it is less sin to do them than to omit them. Therefore, if you will go to hell, go in the fairest path you can in thither. Number three, venture and try. It may be God may hear, not for your prayer's sake, but for his name's sake. The unjust judge helped the poor widow, not because he loved her suit, but for her importunity, or the fact she kept after it over and over again. And so be sure you shall have nothing if you do not seek. You will have nothing if you do not seek. What though you are a dog, yet you are alive, and are for the present under the table. Catch not at Christ, snatch not at his bread, but wait till God give him. It may be you may have him one day. Oh, wonder then at God's patience, that you live one day longer, who have all your lifetime, like a filthy toad, spit your venom in the face of God, that he has never been quit of thee, that he didn't let you go and be by yourself and not influence you anymore and leave you alone. Oh, look upon that black bill that will one day be put in against you at the great day of account, where you must answer with flames of fire about your ears, not only for your drunkenness, your bloody oaths and whoring, but for all the actions of your short life, and just so many actions, so many sins. You have painted your face over now with good duties and good desires, and a little honesty amongst some men is of that worth and rarity that they think God is beholding to them, if he can get any good action from. But when your painted face shall be brought before the fire of God's wrath, then your vileness shall appear before men and angels. Oh, know it, that as you do nothing else but sin, so God heaps up wrath against the dreadful day of wrath. And thus much for man's misery in regard of sin. And we're going to go ahead and stop there for this time. He goes on the next time, or he follows, now follows his misery in regard of the consequence of miseries that follow upon sin. So this was man's misery in regard of sin. And again, this is the natural man. This is what we all are by nature. And he's describing that so that we can get an understanding of that and see ourselves as God sees us, as described in the Bible. Again, we'll go ahead and stop there for now. Lord willing, continue on next time. But until then, go seeking God for an understanding of yourself, of ourselves. May he grant us that understanding of ourselves so that we can come to him in humility and seeking Christ. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.